Hey, it's the Shilling Show, 977-1070. That's the magic number. Let me give the area code. It's 434-977-1070 because we have verified listeners, people who listen to this program regularly from across the country. They can listen live online, and you can too. Just go to shillingshow.com or WINA.com, either one. Click on that Listen Live button, and you will be in digital nirvana with the Shilling Show. So 434-977-1070, the phone line's always open on the Shilling Show. As we welcome back to the program, a regular guest, David Murata, the president of Murata Wealth Management, today talking about raising taxes to balance the budget. By the way, he's online at MurataOnMoney.com. And David, welcome to the Shilling Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, we're enjoying reading the columns in the daily newspaper, now appearing, I believe, on Sundays. With your daughter Megan, it's terrific that you guys are teaming up on these.
Yes, it's good to have another younger voice who's helping to add to the column, and Megan and I are trying to work through a series of articles to try to educate young people about economics, and it's a complex subject that they don't adequately cover in college, or if they do, it's often from a very liberal bent, and yet supply side economics in the econ department at UVA is incredibly good, so. So it seems like every professor other than the economics department seems to have a liberal bent. But the economics department seems to have a great coursework. And I think it was Megan who said in the first 3 weeks of intro to economics, she had learned more politics and more political theory than she had in any of her other courses.
You know, I'm thinking back to my economics education, and the teacher sat up there and lectured for the hour and a half each time, and everything was in the context of pizzas and beers, and that's really all I remember. You have this many pizzas and this many beers, and that was the constant dialogue. But, you know, as we look at this, I think this is so important that it should be taught in high school. I mean, do you agree with me? Because a lot of people never get to college, and if you don't get to college and you miss out on basic economic principles, you're really in trouble.
You know, it's interesting. There's a piece of me that agrees with that, and mm-hmm. then a piece of me that says the studies, however, show that if you take a finance class in high school,
yes.
you actually come away learning nothing practically. And the reason is because there's three things that kids need in order to learn about finances. We have a whole series on how to teach your kids to be money savvy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is they need instruction, but even more importantly than that, they need example and experience. And unfortunately, in a curriculum class where you're just playing games, you don't have example and experience, and that's actually what they need. Megan did a whole series on our website called Rich Dad, Rich Daughter, in which she just went through the lessons she learned by growing up in the Murata household. And it struck me when she was doing that series how much of it was not taught. It was demonstrated. And how much of it was not taught, it was throwing them in the deep end of the pool and actually letting them swim. So Megan's been, you know, doing real work since she was 10. She's been paid for it since she was 14. And now that she's an adult and is grown up, she's had at least, you know, 10 years more experience than anyone else her age in terms of actually thinking about finance and actually experiencing it for herself by doing real work and handling real money.
You told me before, and I thought this was pretty remarkable, and maybe this is covered in your series, but that you actually let your kids handle their own money, like, you know, that you gave them money and they had to make sure they tracked it for their purchases like clothing and other sorts of things.
Yeah.
And I thought that was remarkable. From what age did you do that?
As early as possible, when you think they're ready to handle the decisions
mm-hmm.
for earning. So it's, you know, it starts out with just having money for the things that they want rather than when you're in the toy store and they want a toy, they're begging you for money. But when you're in the toy store and they have money for toys, then they're having to make the hard decisions and they're doing comparison shopping
mm-hmm.
and trying to figure out and separate wants from needs. And that can be done as early as, I think, 5 or 6. It's easy to do that. You have so much money. Here's what it costs. That will take 3 weeks worth of what you get. And,
mm-hmm.
and so you need to save up for it. And then we taught them principles like waiting a week before they purchased it. The same thing is true as they get older and they start wanting clothes or equipment or anything else. And that is you give them a certain amount of money and they can spend it on clothes or equipment or whatever they want. And they have to decide, do I want to have really nice clothes or do I want to have really nice stuff or do I want to have a really nice bank account and money for a rainy day? And And they start having to deal with that. And isn't it great when they can make the mistakes when they're young? And then you still have Christmas if you want them to have nice clothes. Or you still have Christmas. And for Christmases, my wife and I used to give what we called vocational gifts.
Yeah.
And that is, Megan expressed, she's a great graphic designer. And part of it is she expressed an interest. And we got her a graphics tablet and graphics software when she was young. You know, and at a time in which, you know, a lot of other kids were getting, you know, snow skis, and I remember things that her friends were getting, they were all recreational rather than vocational gifts. And I just thought it was more important to actually give them things that might help them find their careers. And I think in Megan's case, the difficulty is she's now good at 20 different things, and it's great to have her working with the firm because she's such a Swiss Army knife.
I think the two of you need to write a book or a series of books on this. Let's go to the phones quickly here. We've got Greg on the line. Hey, Greg, you're on with David Murata.
Well, hey, David. First, I called in to disagree with you that high school finance is not helpful, because it really was helpful to me. I did more financial transactions between the age of 14 and 25 than I ever did in my life because the world and regulation changed. But, I took finance and learned about compounding and amortization, actually even learned that algebraic formulas back then. And when a real estate guy sold me a piece of property, I realized they were messing me over with a balloon note paying whole interest for 5 years and no principal getting knocked down. And my high school finance class, Ms. Bowling, taught me how to figure that out. And then I went to the owner and refinanced and got a different thing with where you were knocking down principal and interest. So I think finance is good, but then I turned around in the middle of my thought and agreed with you, because if you just teach it to them and there's no practical application, they're not going to retain it and it's not going to do them any good. That's why the 4-H was so important to farmers back in the day when most people were in agriculture. So I have to agree there needs to be some sort of practical application.
Yeah, Greg, you're exactly right. The education is important, and I think it will help, and it may even spark some to go get the experience and to be a little bit more savvy in watching for the examples around them. But I agree with you. Doing the education in high school is great. What would be even better is if they had the education plus a practicum, a practical lab plus some kind of an example where you actually met people who were involved.
Well, keep people out of poverty. I mean, it was those simple things at an early age. If they were given a project and they had to figure out the whole aspect, the English as far as writing a letter essay about it, the math as far as figuring out how to do it, rather than just sitting in a classroom being bored and playing on their iPhone, would be better.
We teach kids what we want them to be involved in, and we teach them more about sex ed than we do about finance.
Indoctrination. I'll let you guys go.
It's funny because the radio host who I kind of model myself after, the late, great George Putnam, used to say, they may not know how to read and write, but they sure as hell know how to multiply.
That's right.
I think that's kind of along the same lines.
Yeah.
You know, when we get back here on the other side of the break, and we've just got about a minute left, we're going to be talking about this concept of raising taxes to balance the budget. And I think this may go back to what we were talking about as far as just a lack of education. I mean, are you confident that the people who are making these decisions have a good economic and financial foundation?
No, not really. I mean, most politics has to fit in a soundbite, and economics never fits in a soundbite. In fact, if you had a mantra for economics is the study of all unintended consequences that don't fit in a soundbite. that's a great definition for economics. And so if you're really going to understand economics, you've got to get underlying layers of the cause and effect and the way that incentives affect the different results, and how much influence different incentives have, and what incentives can do and what incentives can't do as well. We were just watching Freakonomics, and you can't give someone an incentive great enough to have them flap their wings and fly. It just doesn't
it
work.
It just won't
right?
work.
No amount of incentives can change that behavior.
Yeah, that's an important concept to grasp. And we'll get into all of this when the Shilling Show returns on the other side of the news. News and weather at the bottom of the hour. I think you'll have more information on Bill Bowling's decision not to run for governor as an independent. We do applaud him for that. And David Murata will continue on the other side. Should we raise taxes? Do we need the balanced approach in order to solve our problems? I'm laughing because it seems so obvious to me, but we'll get into all that. Stay with us here on The Shilling Show. David Murata is our guest here on The Shilling Show. Coming up in hour number two, Ken Boyd will get an update on the Dummler situation in Albemarle County and also things going on with the budget, tax increase, they can do better than that. And that takes us to the topic we're talking about right now. Raising taxes to balance the budget. Is this a good idea? And so you have a great piece at MaradaOnMoney.com that you wrote with your daughter Megan on this topic. And it seems so short-sighted to me, but we're constantly hearing the drumbeat from the president on down that we must have a balanced approach to balancing the budget. I'd like you to respond to that.
Yeah, and really, I mean, this is, goes back to the complexity of economics. Part of it is because conservatives like us have said we need to balance the budget. We need actually to live within our means. And so as a consequence, people say, well, if we need to balance the budget, if that's so important, why don't we just raise taxes to do it?
Mm-hmm.
And the difficulty with that is that supply-side economics suggests that incentives on production are incredibly important, which means if you raise taxes, you will get less production. And people who say, well, the United States has one of the lowest rates among developed countries for taxes would also have to concede that America also has historically had one of the highest rates of growth.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to emulate Europe for their high taxes, you're also going to have to emulate Europe for their lack of growth. And that's a direct result of incentives. And I think we've run this experiment enough times with different countries in different situations to see the trends. And I think if you look at trends as a whole, you'll find that high taxes tends to reduce production on a fairly consistent behavior. Now, if your high taxes are only on a very, very few, it reduces production less.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the high taxes we've had historically have been on a small enough percentage of the population. And also, if you have high taxes but you can avoid them, then it doesn't affect production because people will simply move production around. They'll produce anyway and they'll avoid the taxes. So capital gains taxes, a lot of people can avoid it. It ends up hurting the economy because people can't move money easily, but they can avoid the tax. So the difficulty is when you put taxes on income, it's very difficult for productive people to avoid income.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't work. And
right.
So it's a discouragement to income. Now, there are some ways of avoiding it. We work with a lot of highly affluent people, and you can take production in 1 year and you can spread it out over a number of years, and you can spread it out into your retirement years, which ends up keeping you in the lower tax brackets. There are techniques for that, and you can do it somewhat. But if you're producing year after year after year after year, you can't move it to a different year because every year you've got high production. And so it's very difficult. All you can do is decide to work less. And I can tell you from working with highly productive people that there's a lot of people who are working 40, 50, 60, 70-hour weeks who say, you know what, those last 10 hours just aren't worth it because the government's taking too much of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to cut back on my production, or I'm going to take the money. I'm not going to start that new venture because it will take all of my time to start that new venture. And it's just not worth it because it's the third business on top of two successful businesses, and I'm such in the high tax brackets. It's the return on investment after those high taxes are not worth the return on investment after the first business's low taxes. So if I were single and I didn't have any businesses, I would start that business, employ people, and be productive. But because I'm so successful, I've got two other businesses, I can't start that third business because the return on investment just doesn't make sense.
You know, this is a fascinating topic as we think about productivity, David Murad. I had a guest on the program recently who wrote a book called The 100-Year Dying of the Dollar. Lowell Ponte and Craig Smith wrote this book. And he said, you know, my tax proposal is the more you earn, the less taxes you pay. In other words, the opposite of what we had, because it would encourage people, hey, if I work more, I'm going to pay even less taxes, and it would be a boon to productivity. I'd never considered that before, but I'm wondering what you think of the concept.
Yeah, my father sometimes jokes that we should just tax poverty because you mm-hmm. get less of it. There's some truth to that, and the most efficient tax would be a poll tax. That is, you tax every head. You can't get away from having a head, and if you take whatever money the government needs and you divide up among the number of people, and then everyone owes that fair share,
mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, everything you produce is yours. So you have to produce enough to at least give back to society what society costs, and then beyond that, you don't. That is the most efficient tax mechanism. It's also what got Margaret Thatcher thrown out of office. So it's not going to happen politically.
You know, as we look at these options, one is raising taxes, which appears to be easy to do if you're doing it in a progressive manner. In other words, if you say, I'm going to sick the whole nation on that small group of people over there and pillage them, which is what Barack Obama and his minions do. Or the other option is cutting spending, which granted is politically difficult, but really shouldn't be that hard if you look at the Constitution and say, where should the federal government get its nose out of?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, for conservatives, yes, we want to spend less to balance the budget, and yes, we want taxes low. But given our choice between the two, we would rather just have low taxes and run up all the deficits you want. Because a deficit, the effects of a deficit are easier for people to avoid, and they don't have to avoid it by not producing. If you're running a deficit, I'll produce as much as I possibly can, and then I'll convert that production into anything other than U.S. dollars. Because what a deficit is and what running a deficit is it's really just a tax on people stupid enough to hold dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're holding dollars in your bank account, you're being taxed because of the deficit, and you should put those dollars into something else. So even in our investment strategies, we are trying to hedge ourselves against not being in, or hedge ourselves by not being in U.S. dollars, European euros, and Japanese yen, because those three currencies are being actively devalued. And even though you can't see it against each other, you can't see it because the dollar may be strengthening against the euro. All that means is the euro is dropping faster than the dollar is in value. Or the dollar strengthening against the yen, that just means the yen's going down even faster than the dollar is.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the dollar against other things, like, you know, the cost of a barrel of oil or something like that, you can get a better read on what's actually happening in the background against a value, some things that will hold its value. So we recently reduced the amount that we have in Japanese yen, and we decided for developed countries, we liked Australia and New Zealand debt, and we've got an ETF that invests in Australia and New Zealand debt because we think those countries will hold their value of their currency better. And then emerging market debt, the three things going for emerging market debt is they're not dollars, they're not euros, and they're not yen. And then also the debt-to-GDP ratio for emerging market is 40% on average for the countries, and the debt-to-GDP ratio for developed countries is averaging 100. So developed countries actually have their debt more under control, partly because they just continue to grow their GDP.
Mm-hmm. When we come back on the other side, I want to talk about some other options for people who are looking to avoid inflation. And I know that's, you know, people are hearing about this. We're kind of waiting for the tsunami of hyperinflation. We're going to find out from David if he thinks that's actually coming, maybe when we'll start to see it and what we can do about it. It's 1242 here on The Shilling Show, 977-1070. That's the phone number, 977-1070. There's Luke standing by for your calls. If you have comments, questions, or even challenges for David Murata, we'd love to hear from you. 977-1070, The Shilling Show on WINA, back in a minute. Our final segment with David Murata, we're talking about this concept of raising taxes to balance the budget and why that seems to be so talked about today, whether it's from the local level. People here, four of our six Board of Supervisor members, unfortunately, including Dwayne Snow, voting to increase the tax rate here in Albemarle County. We'll get into that in hour number two, but it happens locally as well as on the state level and on the federal level. 977-1070 is the phone number. If you have comments or questions, we'd love to hear from you. So before the break, we were talking about how it's really a colossally bad idea to be holding cash. And I guess the first question is, you know, for the average person who may not, for whatever reason, have representation like you provide, David, I mean, what do people do? Where do they put their money if it's not in cash? And what if they need to have some liquidity? I'm sorry. Here we go.
Yeah, it's a great question. Obviously, you have to hold some cash because cash is the liquid means to buy and sell and do all your transactions. We recommend that you have, even if you're retired, if you have in cash 5 to 7 years of safe spending, in order that you can always have something that's liquid. Now, you can have that in something which is not dollars, but it needs to be very stable. So Australian dollars or emerging market debt or something like that. But for people who are trying to grow their wealth and they're putting away a little bit each week, having it in something that's going to hold the value against the dollar is great. And there's a few things that we recommend. We have a whole hard asset or resource stocks category, which does very well during inflationary times. But to be really honest, anything in the stock market will hold its value against the dropping dollar because Coke is going to be productive. And if you have shares of stock in Coke, it will be productive. And if the dollar goes down in value, if the dollar drops in value by half, it will take twice as many dollars to buy that share in stock of Coke. So some people are worried about the stock market. It's at a tear. It's on a high. It's going up. And some people are worried that we're going to have a big correction. It's possible. On average, every year we have a correction of at least 14.5%. So if we have an average 14.5% drop, I won't be surprised. But it's also possible that the stock market is just going up because of inflation and the dollar is going down. And putting shares in the stock market just means you're holding your own against what the dollar is being devalued. And so it's not bad just to buy some sort of equity. And you can do it in U.S. stocks. You can do it in foreign stocks. You can do it in resource stocks. You can do it in technology stocks. You can do it in anything, and it's a better safe store of value because now you're actually in the companies which are productive, and you have a stake in all of their profits. And their profits, as inflation goes up, will be ever-increasing dollars. And so there's a sense in which you have hedged yourself against inflation simply by investing in equities.
Let's talk about precious metals. I've heard this talk. In 1900, you could buy a fine suit for an ounce of gold. And today, it's the same. You know, a fine suit would cost you $1,500. And so a lot of people are saying, I'm so fearful of the dollar. I'm so fearful of what's happening here that I'd like to get something really tangible. Do precious metals, and let's just say coins, because a bar is not quite as useful, does that make sense for anybody?
Yeah, it precious metals on average keeps up with inflation, plus or minus a huge random effect. So it is one of the most volatile ways of just keeping up with inflation. And because of that, we don't recommend it to our clients because you're not trying to just keep up with inflation. You're actually trying to have some gain over inflation. Stocks on average make inflation plus 6.5%. And believe it or not, stocks with 6% over inflation have a lower volatility than gold does. So I got married in 1982. In 1980, we were shopping for wedding rings. That was the height of the gold market, $850 an ounce. Adjusted for inflation, that's about $3,000 an ounce today. So gold has never returned to what it was in 1980 when you adjust for inflation. And from 1980, for the next 22 years, it dropped from $850 an ounce down to $230 an ounce. And we hear the ads, you know, gold has never been worth nothing. Well, the stock market's never been worth nothing. But at least the stock market has never had a 22-year slide where it's gone from $850 down to $230. So the volatility of gold is tremendous. And when it looks like the world is going to end and there's political unrest and we've got high deficits, gold skyrockets. So my fear is that gold is still higher because we're anticipating the end of the world with debts and deficits and government shutdowns and things like that. And gold is going to return to a more reasonable value, or at least not keep up with inflation going forward because it's had such a tear to get to this point. Now, I think gold's better valued now than it was a couple of years ago, but still, if I had to choose, I would invest in emerging market equities before I would invest in precious metal coins. And we always ask our clients to keep less than 3-5% of their net worth in gold coins. So I do have a few clients that gold coins is how they got their family out of Nazi Germany. And it's I can sleep better at night knowing I have gold coins effect. And I perfectly understand that. And for 3% of your net worth, if you can sleep better at night, it makes sense. But it's not a way to grow and build real wealth.
You mentioned Australia and New Zealand and their debt. Why those countries? Why not someplace like Canada, a little closer to home? Why do they compare more favorably?
There is a Canadian bond ETF, and we considered it. It was probably my second choice. And Canada is slipping into the ring of fire. Their debt and deficit's getting a little higher. So among all of the countries that are higher than the United States in economic freedom, Canada has the larger debt and deficit. Now, the United States is right behind them, so, or right ahead of them, I should say, in terms of debt and deficit. So Canada's not a bad choice. We look at countries with the most economic freedom and the countries who have a stable monetary supply, which is one of the measurements of economic freedom. And the United States, unfortunately, for the past 3 years, has the dubious distinction. It's one of the three countries that has slipped the most in economic freedom in the last 3 years. And I think a lot of it is due to our government spending, our lack of accountability, and what we're doing to our currency with quantitative easing.
You know, you talk about the currency and people's fears over the U.S. dollar, which I think are well-founded. There was legislation in Virginia this year, although I'm not sure the disposition of it, regarding investigating state currency, an alternative currency to the dollar. And I know this has been discussed in some other states as well. What do you think of that? And what if we had a parallel currency that was actually based on a gold or a silver standard?
Yeah, it's interesting in the sense that currency is just an exchange of goods. Mm-hmm. And there are enough currencies in the world that you can exchange your goods one for another at a short period of time by going through some kind of currency. I'll translate it into currency and I'll translate it just out. Even if you added two zeros to the end of everything that we spend in dollars, the U.S. dollar still has that effect.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certainly no gain from a fiat currency from a state as opposed to a fiat currency from the federal government. Now, if the currency is just backed by ounces of gold or something like that, then you've got a different medium of exchange. First, you translate it into gold, and then you translate it back into something else.
Mm-hmm.
That can work, but that would mean everyone would have to use that currency, and the likelihood of everyone using a state currency is really low. So if you have to have a safe store of value, and that's all you're looking at, I would say the stock market, because it's a safe store of value plus 6.5%. And I know some people think it's not a safe store of value, but the volatility in the stock market is actually less than the volatility in gold. So it provides a safer store than gold does.
Let's go to the phones real quickly. Say hello to Chris. Chris, you're on with David Murata.
Thank you, Rob. David, I was curious if you could answer this question. You said that we made a list of not being particularly a free market. I'm wondering, is the things that you listed that caused this to happen to our economy, is this the same thing that Europe, is this the same path that Europe went down? And is not one of the European countries very high on the list of being a free market? I seem to remember hearing that, but I'm not sure. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay.
Yeah, Chris, it's a great question. We use the Heritage Foundation's Index of Economic Freedom. They take every country in the world and they rank them on a scale of 0 to 100. I think you get a point for being a country. So I think North Korea is a 1. And the highest countries are Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, Switzerland, and Canada, and then Chile and the United States. So those are all in the top 10, the United States being 10th. Canada and the United States is in the mostly free category. The others are all in the free category. And it goes from free, mostly free, moderately free, mostly unfree, and downright repressed. And the indicators they use, there's 10 different indicators. And you're correct, there is a second tier of the mostly free countries, and some of the European countries do better than others. So, for example, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Austria, Germany, the Netherlands, the northern European countries tend to do better. If you look at the high debt and deficit countries, what we call the PIG countries, because it's P-I-I-G-S, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain, they are not high in economic freedom. And a lot of the things they do to try to handle their economy just doesn't handle it as well. But the countries with the most economic freedom have higher GDP growth. And that's why they have higher stock market growth. And we actually use that as an investment strategy. Investing in countries with the most economic freedom, on average, makes about 4 or 5% over the foreign index.
David Murata, always an informative and important hour. Visit him online at muratahonmoney.com. I always look forward to these conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much. All right, so if you didn't get in on open phones on the last hour, Franklin, Chris, we'd love to hear from you. 977-1070. There's Luke. It's 977-1070. And then Ken Boyd. Stay with The Shilling Show.